Thanks, Stacey. I'm Kylie. I'm an alcoholic. And this is our theme for the weekend from page 164. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 164.
Thanks, Kylie. Before we have Stacy introduce our speaker, we're going to do a quick prayer for step 8, and we'll end with the step 9 prayer. We could have a moment of silence for the still suffering alcoholic, both in and outside of these rooms. We can take that now. Higher power, I ask your help in making my list of all those I have harmed. I will take responsibility for my mistakes and be forgiving to others as you are forgiving to me. Grant me the willingness to begin my restitution. This I pray. Over to Stacy.
Thanks so much. I'm trying to find what I was, there it is. Okay. I don't know page numbers like that. So, okay. I'm Stacy, I'm alcoholic. It's my pleasure to get to introduce Matthew. I'm so excited. So from a very young in my sobriety, I was given CDs. They weren't on tapes, you know, I was given CDs, but, they were just given to me, and it was like, how do I make it from the meeting to home? And Matthew was one of the very first tapes that I got given. You know, we were doing this as a committee and pretty much just going through the steps. And it was like, who do you like on this step? I'm just going to tell, I hope you tell this part of your story, Matthew. And it's, he makes this amends. That's this gigantic financial amends. And he says, it's like walking up to a pool with an eyedropper, you know, one day I'll swim. And that's exactly how I have felt with my financial amends. And today I wouldn't say that I'm swimming, but there's water in the bottom of the pool. And so it's definitely changed my life. So I'm going to read the Ninth Step Promises. And so we pocket our pride. We go to it, illuminating every twist of character, I don't think I'm on the right page. Haha, hold on. Why can't I find this right now?
Page 83.
And thank you. Thank you. Okay, because it was at the bottom. All right. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Go ahead, Matthew.
Hey, Stacy. Good to see you. Good to see everybody. Hi, June. Great to see Matt earlier. Israel, fascinating story. I'm a raised Irish Catholic and left the seminary in a huff, but never quite made it to becoming a Hasidic Jew. Wow, you know, it's just been thrilling to be on this morning and to be listening to everybody. There's a lot of my friends on here. Hold on a second. Come on, Delana. Come on. My dog's afraid of doorways, and she'll sit in the doorway and whine throughout the whole talk, so I just had to get her through the doorway. Anyway, I get to speak on the 8th and 9th step, and I always think, first of all, I'm always relieved when I'm asked to speak on a step, because I'm tired kind of my story, you know, and there's a lot of my friends on this call that I know what I mean about doing that. But the other thing is, it's also, I'm a musician, among other things. And when you ask to speak about a step or two steps, it's like, you know, tell me about two notes from Jimi Hendrix, Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock. You know, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, they're exciting, but you really got to hear the other notes, you know, because they all go together. But what I really love about this opportunity that Stacy gave me, and I'll try to tell the story that you asked her, Stacy, is what I wanted to do at the beginning of this is I wanted to talk about the history of where the amends process actually originated that has impacted all of us. It was almost, it was 1908, I think, well before AA, when the amends process started that directly, hey Mark, that directly came into our lives. And I think that's fascinating. Before I do that, I'm just going to say this about the eighth step, because I'm going to focus on the ninth step, which actually came first. We were introduced to the ninth step before Bill invented the eighth step. But the, you know, the made a list of people we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Sometimes people treat it like the sixth step, like, oh, you know, it's not, six is just a fluff step, and then seven's the step, and eight's just, you know, he needed 12, so there's eight, and now there's, you know, then we do nine. And really, it's such an important step, because I know through my own experience and through sponsoring many, many people, by the way, my sobriety, it's May 16th, 1993. So I was an old man by the time the earlier panel had gotten, they were well into their sobriety. I was 31 when I got sober, late to the party. But, you know, I know from my own experience that I didn't even consciously realize that I was unwilling to make amends to some people. I thought my reasons were good, you know, for certain people. And, you know, making the list, I actually did that with my sponsor based on my fifth step. But I will say, you know, the reasons I often hear and some of the reasons I had was, hey, they did more to me than I did to them. They owe me more than I owe them in some cases. And what I've learned over the years and of doing this work myself is that this whole program is about your freedom, my ability to look people in the eye and walk free on earth. And if I'm keeping score, I am as far away from freedom as could possibly be. So it doesn't matter what they did. It matters what you do, or I do. I had a friend that owed a guy $5,000 once, and he was mad at him because he felt that he hadn't paid him appropriately for some gigs he did. And I said, look, do you want to be free? You stole $5,000. And he sent the guy $5,000, and he had found the guy's address, and he was unwilling to make the amends. I had to make him do it. And the guy sent him $35,000 saying, hey, you never got the residual checks from the album we made, and I didn't know where to find you. So he had, like, begrudgingly not made that amend. So before I get into my experience with amends, I really would like to talk about the history of amends, and that there's a spotlight feature. Now would be the time, Mike or Stacy. Wow, I just became super big on my own screen. So in 1908, there was this guy, Frank Buchman, okay? And Frank Buchman was a guy who had started a shelter for young boys in the slums of Philadelphia. And he was really good at what he did. He took wayward kids off the street. He treated them with love and respect. And he had a great record for being effective with this kind of work. The problem was, is his budget always went larger than, his spending went larger than the budget, largely because he decided to feed these kids good food, like meat and vegetables and potatoes and stuff. And every other one of these kind of houses fed rice and beans. So he was brought before the board for the umpteenth time and told, hey, man, you can't do that anymore. Rice and beans. And he said, how can I teach about God's love and not be loving? So they said, sorry, man, rice and beans. And he left. He quit. He wouldn't cut back on the budget. And he left his job where he was very effective. And his resentment, I think I'm shaking a little, so I don't know how much this helps. So there you saw him. his resentment actually, for some reason, now I'm seeing Stacy. His resentment now was consuming him, right? So he lost a lot of things. He's not an alcoholic, but he lost the act, and he started, you know, his health was going bad, and he was in the dumps. And he said, but he said at the time, everywhere I went, I took me with me. And so he went on to the to Europe and ended up in England in July, and he was just falling apart. He was a mess, not an alcoholic. But on July 27th, 1908, he decided to go hear this guy speak, F.B. Meyer. He's a famous minister, and he was supposed to be speaking at this little church in Keswick, England. And just like most of us, he showed up on the wrong day, and F.B. Meyer wasn't there. In fact, there were only 17 people in this little church, and it was this Jesse Penn Lewis, this young woman was speaking on the cross of Christ. And while Frank Buchman was sitting in the audience in the congregation, he looked up at the cross and it became the letter I. So the cross went from being a cross to becoming the letter I. And he realized that he was the problem. He was entirely the problem. And so he went back to his hotel and he wrote to every member of the board. And he wrote this letter. I am writing to tell you that I have harbored an unkind feeling towards you. At times I conquered it, but it always came back. Our views may differ, but I trust as brothers we must love. I write to you for forgiveness and to assure you that I love you and trust by God's grace I shall never more speak unkindly of you or disparagingly of you. And he mailed those letters on July 27, 1908. So 112 years ago he did that. And he immediately felt free. And he walked down into the lobby of the hotel he was staying in. And there was a Cambridge University student who was a mess. And he said, I need to tell you this story about what just happened to me. And he told him what happened to him and the freedom he found. And the guy on the spot said, I want to change my life. Help me change my life. And Frank went on to continue to do that and eventually found a group that I think we're all going to be familiar with. But that comes up next. So 1908, Frank Buchman writes six letters of amends to the church board that had told him he was feeding the people too well at his home for boys. Well, he was also friends with this guy, Sam Shoemaker, and he went to see him in China in 1917. And Sam really, really respected Frank. And he went up to him and had a real honest conversation with him. And he said, you know, I've been kind of a pious fraud. I'm pretending to serve God, but actually keeping all the trump cards in my own hands. Now, I'm sorry, and I trust you'll forgive me, but I have this, you know, ill will. I don't like China. I don't like Chinese people. I don't like the culture here. And Buchman said, you're already freely forgiven. You're always forgiven. And Sam said, well, what's the next step? And he said, well, you have to make amends to your class because you've been harboring resentment. So he went in front of his class and he told them, all of his students, that I don't like China. And they all kind of laughed. It's not like they couldn't tell, right? But he had an amazing, profound spiritual experience on the spot. And he stayed with Buchman for 21 years. And they brought this revolution that they called the Oxford Group into 1920s America. And the Oxford Group would have these things called house parties. And sometimes they were like AA conventions, a bunch of people at a hotel. And sometimes they were like AA meetings. It was a group of people at a house. They actually coined the phrase sharing experience, strength, and hope. And that's what these guys started to do. So Buchman talks to Shoemaker in China after making his amends. Shoemaker makes his amends and becomes immediately more effective at what he does in his life, at helping people change and serving others. And around that time, there was a house party in a hotel. And Jim Newton, this guy, in 1922, he walks into an Oxford Group house party in Wichita, Massachusetts. I think I said that wrong. He thought he was walking into a dance. He was a salesman. And he walked into this house party following two girls. He thought he was going into a dance. And he immediately heard the message he needed to hear. He walked up to Sam Shoemaker and said, "I need help." And Sam said, "You need to take stock of your life. You need to surrender your life to God, and you need to make restitution." And right on the spot, Jim Newton started living a guided life. Now, coincidentally, Jim worked for the Firestone tire company, and he went off and tried to help Bud Firestone, the son of the big employer, Harvey. And it was his alcoholic son. Now, Jim didn't do so well with Bud, but he introduced him to Sam Shoemaker, who really brought Bud to never drink again through the short four steps that they had in the Oxford group. Well, Harvey Wines Firestone was so impressed with this that he convinced other industrialists in this little town where all of the tires were made and the cars were made, called Akron, Ohio, to have an Oxford group meeting. And they had it in the Mayflower Hotel in January 1933. You guys may recognize the Mayflower Hotel. Something really important happens there a few years later. But in that Oxford group meeting where Jim Newton had talked to Bud Firestone and Harvey Firestone had made this possible was a woman named Henrietta Seiberling and a guy named T. Henry and Clarence Williams, all really important people in AA. Well, Jim Newton was really, really trying hard to stay close and work with people. Sam Shoemaker had come back to the States and started the Calvary Church in New York City. And the Calvary Church did not only regular Christian church stuff, but it had like a house, like a halfway house for destitute men who are alcoholics or homeless. And in that church, there were many, many families prominent in New York that came into contact with them. And one of them was the Hazard family, a very wealthy family. And Roland Hazard, if you guys remember from the Big Book, he's the guy that went over to see Carl Jung and still drank again. And Carl Jung said, "You know, I'm sorry, but you're hopeless unless you have a spiritual experience." So Roland started hanging out at Oxford group meetings, but he was getting drunk all the time. And so he was going on a train trip once, and Sam Shoemaker gave him a book called I Was a Pagan by Vic Kitchen. And he read the book, and he did totally identified, and he went out and started making restitutions for all the things that he had done in his wealthy, privileged life that hurt others. And he worked very hard with Sam Shoemaker for a long time. So that was 1933. So one of the people that Roland Hazard came into contact with was an old friend of his, Ebby Thatcher. Now, Roland was a terrible drunk, and he had become sober. So when he showed up at Ebby Thatcher's court case, the judge recognized this guy from a prominent family who had gotten well. And he said to the judge, "Will you let Ebby come with me?" Now, just take a look at this guy. This is the guy that Bill Wilson says, "One time we chartered a plane to finish a drunk." The reason he got arrested, the reason that Roland Hazard went to see him, is he was supposed to be painting the summer house for the family, because he was a terrible screw up in the family. He was the black sheep. And he wasn't doing very well, because he would paint it and then there would be pigeons on the roof and they'd poop on the paint. And he'd shoot at the pigeons with shotguns and blow parts of the house away. And one night he came home really late from a bar and he missed his driveway and he drove through the house next door and came into the kitchen, and it was like 5 a.m. and there was a woman in there, and he got out of the car in the kitchen and said to the woman, "Do you have any coffee?" And he got arrested for this, a story that's been validated a number of times, but he got arrested. And then Roland Hazard said, "Release him to me, I'd like to take him." And he got Ebby to move into the Calvary Mission in New York City. And he was changed by the steps of the Oxford group. And he had this friend, Ebby, after he had 6 weeks sober, he realized that if he was going to keep the beautiful life he was developing, he'd have to give it away. So he went to see his friend in his kitchen, and his friend's name was Bill Wilson, and this is 1934. So we all know who Bill Wilson was, right? So Bill Wilson listens to this guy, and he didn't want the God thing, not at all, right? But he could really see that Ebby was changed, just like a lot of us at AA realized, hey, whatever my prejudices, these people are really different than I am, and they sound like they used to be like me. So he attended all of this stuff, and he Bill eventually did get sober through contact with Ebby. And, you know, the story, he's in Akron, Ohio, at the Mayflower Hotel, the same hotel where the group was, on Mother's Day. And he called Henrietta Cyberling, who put him in touch with Dr. Bob. Now, Dr. Bob started drinking right after Bill called on him. And they started trying to help people. But Bob believed that making amends to those he had harmed would destroy his, put his family further at risk. So this is Bob. He started drinking again. He didn't make his amends and he was completely demoralized. And on the way to perform a surgery, they steadied his hands. Bill and his wife and steadied his hands with some beer. And he went to the surgery, but he didn't come home from the surgery. So they all thought he went and got drunk again. But in 1935, what Bob did is he went around and he made all of his amends that day in the town. And after he made his amends, he never drank again. And he has had a profound effect, he and Bill, right? So what I'd like to emphasize that I took away from this history, and I'm not done with it yet, is that because this guy 112 years ago in Keswick, England, made amends, his heart was clear, and he started having a really authentic, profound effect on the people he was trying to help. Then he helped Sam Shoemaker, who also then started having a profound effect on people he could help. And Jim Newton and Roland Hazard and Ebby Thatcher and Bill Wilson and Bob. And then there's another part of the lineage here. This is May 16th, 1993. This is me weighing 108 pounds the day I got sober 27 years ago, last Saturday. And I don't put myself up here tongue in cheek. I inherited this wisdom of these steps. And I started my ninth step, which I will tell you about in a minute, changed me so profoundly that I've been able to have an effect in my life, in my family, and in other people's lives. And there's one more part of this history that I wanted to add. It's a lot of people don't know about this last bit. That's you. That's you. Because this guy made this amends in 1908 in Keswick, England, you have been given a tool that is so profoundly powerful that you will be amazed before you are halfway through. That's what it says in the promises. And the promises come in the ninth step, those particular promises. And I like that it says you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. Because we're often very daunted by the mountain of amends we have to make. And I think the message of you will be amazed before you're halfway through is it's a process. You don't have to be all the way through to start to see what's going to happen to you spiritually. You just have to be in the process. And I just think that that's so beautiful, that history that I just told you, because all that guy wanted to do was stop hating these people. And he realized, looking at the cross of Christ, that it was the letter I, and he was the problem. And that's the great big shift. And I heard all these people on the panel earlier say, I didn't want what you had. I didn't like you. And then you sort of come to believe and come to realize, hey, I am the problem. It's not everybody else. That's a profound shift. That's a profound spiritual shift from me against you to, hey, maybe I'm the problem. So now I want to talk about my experience with amends. And part of the reason I showed you this is because this is not a new spiritual idea. You know, it's in every major religion, this is true. Like Hu Ning, there's a Chinese philosopher years and years, I don't even know, hundreds or thousands of years ago, said, by amending our mistakes, we get wisdom. By defending our faults, we betray an unsound mind. This is old stuff. You know, when you actually really go around and do this work, and also now I'll cut from all the big history and my nerdy excitement about that stuff and tell you my experience. You know, when I was 31 years old, I got sober. I had hurt a lot of people. I had hurt some people in some ways I could never, ever, ever make amends to them. On May 16th, 1993, 27 years ago, the day of my last drunk, I had a daughter with an 18-year-old girl. I was 31 years old. So my daughter and I just celebrated our 27th birthday. I was cruel to her mother. All through the pregnancy, I was psychologically cruel. I was physically cruel, and I've never been like that. In the depths and despair of my unbelievable bondage of self manifested as alcoholism, I did horrible things to people. And I knew I could never make some of those things right. I also owed people lots and lots of money. I also had just done stupid, petty things throughout my life. And I really tried to be thorough on my fourth and fifth step. And I remember when I made my list, I went to my sponsor and I said, you know, I got these people on here, but I can't make amends to this one guy. And before I get to him, one of the ways I ended up making amends before I even got to the ninth step was I was walking into a meeting with my sponsor when I was 90 days sober. And I said, you know, I thought having Phoebe was the worst thing that could happen to me. I thought Anna ruined my life by having that baby. And now I realize that as a sober guy, and I'm 90 days sober, that I love Phoebe more than I could love anyone else in the world. And my sponsor totally ignored me. He walked into the meeting. And, you know, I'm self-centered and insecure. So I'm like furtively looking at him through the whole meeting, hoping he'll like smile at me or give me some positive feedback. And he just didn't look at me, you know. And so he used to drive me to meetings because my car was unsafe. And I walked out from that meeting and I hadn't talked to him through the whole meeting. And I said, hey, maybe you didn't understand what I was trying to tell you earlier. But, you know, I think I love Phoebe more than I even love myself. I'm 90 days sober. And my sponsor puts his hands up and goes, hey, stop it. And I said, what? And he goes, how much child support do you pay? And I said, well, God, I live with my parents now and I work at a loading dock from midnight to 4 a.m. and I deliver packages during the day. I have 2 degrees and I can't get a decent job. And he said, I know your circumstances. How much child support do you pay? And I said, well, I don't pay any. And he goes, then you're just kind of full of it, aren't you, Mr. I love my daughter. He said, don't tell me you love your daughter. Show me you love your daughter. He said, this is a program of action. You must know that. I was going to 3 meetings a day then. He goes, you go to a gazillion meetings. You must know we don't talk about it. We do it. He goes, I got an idea. If you show me you love your daughter, you'll never have to tell me again. I'll just know. And we had a real quiet drive home. You know, I was like planning his death and he's living in the present moment. It was really, I was very uncomfortable and he was very peaceful. And we got home and I, you know, I'm living with my mom and my dad. I've got like, all I've got left of my former life is a life-size poster of Eric Clapton in my old bedroom. You know, pretty hard to hold on to righteous indignation when you're 31 walking around the bedroom at your parents' house. And I'm, you know, making the rounds, angry. I got to find a new sponsor. This guy's insensitive, you know, all the newcomer stuff. And I'm walking around and slowly it's so obvious. My face is like beet red because he's right. I really wanted someone to think I was a really super good guy. God, that guy really loves his daughter. There's no actual physical evidence that he loves her, but he really does. Just listen to him talk about it. You know? And so I called Anna, you know, and I said, hey, I don't make much money, but I should help you. And she goes, oh my God, that'd be so great. This is so hard. I didn't know how hard it was going to be. I'm trying to get to college next year. And so I said, well, I don't make much money. You know, how much do you want? And she was so smart. She goes, no, not how much. She goes, I'll just take a percentage of your paycheck. And then we'll be good. And I didn't realize how smart she was, but she was betting on my horse. You know, she thought this guy is going to get his act together. He's going to make some real money someday. I thought, like somebody said earlier, I'm just going to live at my parents' house and go to AA meetings and have crappy jobs and be happy, joyous, and free. And I was happier than I'd been in a long time, honestly. But so I just started giving her this percentage. You know, every 2 weeks I had to go cash my check at a check cashing place because no one would give me enough. Count. And I take this money every 2 weeks, every 2 weeks. And with the day I met Phoebe, 27 years ago last Saturday when they held her in my arms for the first time, and I had been drunk all night and I was about to get sober and I really wasn't sure that was going to happen. I wanted to shoot myself. And I'm not like, oh, I want to kill myself. I mean, I decided out of the spot, when I give Phoebe back to Anna, I am going to go home, take that gun from under my pillow and shoot myself, because I'm bad and they're good. I'm dirty and they're clean. I'm disgusting and they're beautiful. I couldn't do it. I couldn't be a dad like that. They look so perfect. And I had done so many horrible things to that girl when she was pregnant. It was amazing. They were healthy. I was ashamed and I didn't want to live anymore. So I paid his amends every 2 weeks. And at a year, I was holding Phoebe. She was one and she was so great. She had this gigantic, she's 100% Irish. We've cursed her, you know. She has this big head, big blue eyes. She's hanging her head against me, and she's pulling on me and my lips and my mouth. And just, I loved seeing her. And I didn't realize it at the time, but one of the reasons I liked being with Phoebe my first year of sobriety is she didn't think I was a loser. She was like real pure and beautiful. I'm the guy that came with money and played with her, you know, like what a cool guy. Like, he shows up, everybody gets a little happier around the house. He runs around. We just did fun stuff. And I had her sitting on my lap at a year of sobriety and I'm bouncing her up and down. And I go, Phoebe, I'm your dad. I'm going to take you to your first day of kindergarten. I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. I'm going to buy you a car when you're 16. I didn't have a car when I said that to her. I didn't know how I was going to do that. But I just was sure, you know, somehow I'll buy you a car. And I'm going to pay for college. I was just so overjoyed with my role in her life. And she just smiled at me, banging me and hit with my head. And you know, a year before that, I wanted to end my life because I met her. And you guys said, just do these things. You didn't validate my intellectual take on all of the steps. I've got opinions, you know, I have a degree in religious studies and a degree in English literature. I am completely unemployable, but full of opinions, you know, and I had all these ideas and no one wanted to hear them. They just said, did you send a check? Did you go by? Did you see her? Did you see your parents today? Did you take care of stuff? And that kind of stuff. And in 1 year, I went from dreading ever being involved with this little person to loving my life with her. And I did. I took her to her first day of kindergarten. I took her to her first day of first grade. I bought her a car when she was 16. And I just finished paying for nursing school a year ago. And Phoebe's a nurse. And like Stacy, she's helping us with this virus. And she was here, sitting right there last week, because she drove down from Portland and said, Dad, our birthday is Saturday. I want to come see you. It is so powerful. You'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And you'll be really a channel to help other people. You know, Phoebe's going to get married in a few months, and she's had a stepdad since she was 3. And a stepmom since she was 3. I got married and her mom got married. And she asked me to walk her down the aisle. And I said, will Jason be upset by that? And she said, Dad, you're my model. You're the man of character in my life. I'm the man of character. The thief. So there was this other amends, the guy I started to tell you about. I wrote this list and I owed this guy $15,000. His name was Larry. And he had lived in my apartment and he kept the lease in his name, but he moved to Mexico City. And he was going to come back and he wanted to keep the apartment, but my rent kept getting lost in the mail. It was the mail in Mexico is apparently terrible, because every time I, you know, imaginarily mail that check, it never arrived. And I did some other kind of hinky stuff. And when I got sober and I wrote that list, I figured I owed Larry $15,000. So I wrote this list and I came to my sponsor and I had all the usual people, my parents and past employers, but I said, hey, you know, I wrote Larry $15,000 and it looked to me like $10 million because I didn't have that kind of money. I'd been a rock and roll musician. You know, I sometimes had $15,000 and I spent it real fast. And I wasn't going to be getting out of my parents' house soon. And, you know, and I said to my sponsor, I don't think I can make this. Remember willing to make step eight, being willing? And he said, why not? And I said, well, I don't have $15,000. And he said, well, what do you think? You're going to go over to his house with a briefcase and put $15,000 on his porch? And I said, well, yeah, kind of. And he goes, man, you are grandiose, boy. He said, just chill out. He said, how much money do you have in your pocket right now? And on that particular day, I had $20. And he said, if you sent Larry that 20 bucks, how much would it affect you? And I said, well, not at all. My lifestyle would not change if I sent the 20 bucks to Larry. So I wrote a letter to Larry, and it was beautiful, man. It was really a work of art. And then I took it to my sponsor, and he cut out all the self-justification parts. And it was more like a crappy telegram by then. Honestly, it wasn't a work of art. And he said, look, just send this paragraph where you really own it and tell him you're going to send him anything you can. And he hopes this is all right. So I put that $20 in an envelope and I sent it to Mexico City. I got there. Amazing how much the mail changed after I got sober. And so then I'm like 2 months later, my sponsor sees me at a meeting and he goes, hey, have you sent Larry any money? And I go, yeah, remember I sent him 20 bucks. He goes, no, have you sent him any more money? And I said, well, yeah. So then that's when I got my little notebook. I got a notebook and I wrote the date I'd sent him 20 bucks. Then I sent him another little letter and sent him 20 more bucks. And I wrote it down, 40 bucks. Now I owe $15,000, right? So I started doing this once a month, sending him 20 bucks. I started making more money, which I, as a result, got more child support for Anna. I started doing these things, and sometimes I'd send him 100, sometimes I'd send him 50, sometimes I'd send him 20. Sometimes I'd forget. I'd look at the notebook and go, oh, crap, it's been 2 months, you know? And that's where Stacy's analogy came from, is I really felt like I owed this guy $15,000. I'm sending him 20 to 50 bucks a month. I felt like I was walking out in my backyard and there was an empty swimming pool and I had a little eyedropper. And I was putting a drop in going, someday I'm going to swim. Someday I'm going to swim in this pool. And it, you know, it evaporates. And, you know, I've added up like, oh, it's been a year. I'd add it up. Like, oh, I paid him 300 bucks. I owe $15,000, you know. So I just kept sending him the money. In about 6 years, 7 years into it, he calls me and he says, hey, man, quit sending me this money. And I said, why? And he said, well, I'm back in California. I've seen you. I've seen your wife. I've seen your life. You're the guy I always wanted you to be. He said, you're like a good man. You're a good son. You're a good father. You're a good husband. You're the guy I fell in love with to start. He said, look, you paid me back by the way you live your life. So while he's talking, I'm adding up the money, right? Because when I'm paying you back, I am meticulous about my records. When I'm ripping you off, I'm kind of vague, you know. I think it was, I don't know, 15, I don't know. And I added it up, and I had paid him $7,000, exactly $7,000 on the day he called. And I said, Larry, that's great and everything, but I owe you more than 50%. I owe you $8,000. He goes, please stop sending me the money. So I hung up, and I made the mistake of calling my sponsor. Like, this is a cautionary tale for all of you. Like, don't call your sponsor. Because he was so cool the way he did this. I said, hey, I'm done paying Larry back. And he goes, really? That's amazing. And he goes, you paid him $15,000. I go, no, I'll know. But, you know, he called. And he goes, oh, okay. He said, God, that's that guy you sent 20 bucks to when you lived at your mom's and dad's house and you had that lame job at midnight. And I said, yeah. And he goes, God, man, now you've got the life everybody wants to have. You want to stop doing what's working? That's cool. And he hung up. And I remember looking at the phone, going, why did I call him? That's so stupid. That was an $8,000 phone call to a guy I really liked like 10 minutes before that. And now it was just all of a sudden. So I call Larry up and say, you know, you're not going to understand this. And I don't care if you do, but I have to pay you back. And I had made amends to everybody, my parents, Anna, and my parents were very dear to me. My mother died of cancer. And I was holding her in my arms and I made amends to her. My father was very lonely and I spent a lot of time with him. And he died about just a few weeks after that conversation with Larry. And I was devastated. And he had left us money. He'd also gifted us some money just when he was dying. And I had a little family. I had a little boy and Phoebe and Pip, my wife. And we really needed the money. But I went to Pip and said, you know, I think I have to send Larry. And my wife said something. My wife's British. So just FYI, if you marry British, you're going to be the romantic one in the relationship. Okay? They're not going to pull that side. So that's fallen squarely on me. And my wife keeps her feelings kind of close to her. But I've never doubted our love. So that's been fine. But this kind of surprised me. She said, you need to send Larry $8,000. And I said, yeah. And she goes, look, I've never met anyone that lives like you do. It seems to work really well for us. I trust that this is the right thing to do. Do whatever you think is right. Now, we needed that money. You know, we really did. And I wrote a check for $8,000. And I sent it to Larry. This one I sent FedEx, you know. You know what? Really not trusting the mail with the $8,000. And he called. I sent it overnight. He called the next day and he said, you're not going to believe this. And I said, what? He said, well, Wendy and I was a best man at his wedding. He said, Wendy and I are looking at each other and we've been talking all night because we found out she's pregnant. And we just moved back to California and we've been renting this house and we didn't know how to pay for this house because we only had $12,000 saved and we needed $20,000 for a down payment. And your check came today. So the loser, the flake, the criminal, the man in the bondage of self helped this really lovely man and his beautiful wife buy a house with his own money. You know, that's the part that I have to say, which I don't like to say, but because that kind of takes my Jimmy Stewart feeling about the whole thing. But, you know, it was his money. I just held on to it for him until he really needed it. but you know, the moral of the story is you don't have, however daunting the task, and I know people on this Zoom meeting, some of you owe a lot more than that. Some of you, that's a big number. It was a big number to me. It really doesn't matter. You'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And I know that a lot of my material success, I'm successful. Pip and I raised 4 children to adulthood. 4. They just finally moved out. The last 2 19-year-olds are gone. And, you know, we did that without worrying. We did that with giving. We did that with putting the bread on the water. And this is a great example. So I had Larry and I had Anna. And I do want to tell you about one other amends before I talk about something else for a second. When Phoebe went to school with Anna, Anna went up to Chico State. And I had gone to Chico State. I actually graduated from Amherst in Massachusetts, but I went to Chico State. And I had played in a really good band up there. And I had worked in a bookstore, Tower Books. It's a Tower Record Company had a bookstore there. And I stole from that bookstore. And now I'm sober and I'm back in Chico 10 years later to visit my daughter. And I can't walk down Main Street. I don't know why. It's got like a force field around. There's Main goes one way. Broadway goes the other way. It's a very small farming town. Got a lot bigger now, but I realized I couldn't walk by Tower Books. I didn't even know if anybody still worked there. They worked there when I worked there. But I called my sponsor and I said, hey, and I wasn't in the 8-step yet. And I said, hey, I can't walk by this street. And I realize it's because I ripped off this bookstore. And he goes, well, how much did you steal? And I said, I think like $250. I just nickel and dime for stuff I needed that day, you know, and it was the cash cow. And he said, well, look, I don't normally do this because you're not really at the night step, but since you're there, you're willing to go in and say, I'm working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I made a list of people I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. You're on my list. He said, just go with all the guardrails. Explain exactly why you're there. So I did. I went and waited, and it was painful, man. The two people, Jeffrey, who was the manager, I was one of the other managers, and Sue, who was just a clerk there at the time, they were still there, and they were. She was the manager now, and he was the shipping clerk, which was a little odd. And they weren't there. They had gone to lunch. And a couple of people I knew were still working there, and they're like, hey, wow, like, you look great. We haven't seen you forever. And I was just sweating. I was so afraid to make this amends. I was so embarrassed. And I went into the office when they got there, and the office was almost as big as my desk is right now. I mean, our knees were touching. There was them, those two and me. And I was so scared. And I said, you know, I stole from you. They knew. I got fired. I said, I stole from you 10 years ago, and I think it was about $250. And I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and part of my step work is I made a list of people I'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them, and I'm here to make it right, and I want to give you money. And I didn't have a lot of money. And I said, I can give you some money now. And Jeffrey, the guy who was the manager and became the shipping clerk, he was started to cry. Like not loudly, just tears started running down his face. And I go, Jeffrey, what's wrong? And he said, I've been going to AA for 25 years and I can't get 30 days sober. And you're sitting here making amends to me? And I said, Jeffrey, I don't know that much about it. I'm new at it. But if you want to call me, here's my phone number. And he looked at it and goes, oh, yeah, that's long distance. And he threw it away. And I'm like, geez, I don't know why you only have 30 days. And but you know, whatever effect that had on him, it was so freeing for me, you know, to see like, I didn't expect that. And I've heard something years and years ago in Minnesota, like probably 20 years ago, a guy said, God never brings two people together to help just one of them. And I think this is a really good example of that. And I tried to give them money and they wouldn't take it. And then I sent them a check and said, look, they go, how do we ring this up? And they did have a prison program where they ripped the covers off books and returned the covers and they'd send the old books to the prison program. And I said, just spend it on them, you know, just send it to them. But anyway, what I wanted to convey today, talking about 8 and 9, is that, you know, the spiritual work, right? There's a line in the big book about that, you know, that based on my spiritual condition, it talks about, you know, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And that actual sentence is in the ninth step. The spiritual life isn't a theory. In other words, it's not about how close you feel to God or how much you pray and meditate, which I do very, very much. I really love the 11th step. Or how pious you look. It's, are you living a spiritual life? And just like Yu Ning said, by amending our mistakes, we get wisdom. By defending our faults, we betray an unsound mind. Living a spiritual life is amending your behavior or changing the way you live so as to be more helpful and less harmful. And that's been my experience, you know. One of the great things about staying sober for a while and staying real close and really loving the steps is they kind of blow up. Like they kind of like are little stars. You know, you go to the star and you're like, wow, man, I really need that. I need to do a third step. The fifth step. I need that. It's a little bright star. And then it explodes. Like, and it becomes so much broader and so much bigger to my whole life. Like the first step and powerlessness and unmanageability are such beautiful news to me now. And it's so deep and wide, you know, and the ninth step is that kind of thing. It's like, I found that my recovery has been a series of invitations to grow. I've never had a year in recovery where I'm like, hey, I made it. I'm spiritually above it all now, and I'm always happy, and there's never any worries about bills or sickness or anything, you know, pestilence. And then I get invited. You know, I get, like a lot of people on this call know, my wife had a stroke after we were married for 5 years. I've been her caregiver in that I keep her safe. I mean, she's very functional. I help her get dressed and stuff like that for years and years. I got invited to grow. Right now I have undiagnosed chronic pain. I've been to several specialists since November. I actually have a procedure coming up where one of my doctors thinks I might have cancer. I'm being invited to grow, but I'm not afraid. I'm frustrated. At first I was afraid because I thought a lot about my family, but I'm not afraid because I'm clean. I'm really clean inside. Really, I make a point of staying current with my sponsor, of giving back what I've taken and more than that. And what this has to do with the ninth step is, you know, I don't regret the past nor wish to close the door on it. I don't have fears of financial insecurity. And I'm going to share this little analogy about fear before I stop talking. Because one of the things that the ninth step promises says is fears, the many have, will leave you. And I read this beautiful book called Deep and Simple by Bo Lazoff. And he talks about fear in the most beautiful way. He said, if a coal miner goes down in a coal mine shaft and he's got a light on his helmet, and as soon as he's 20, 30 yards in that coal mine, there's darkness and danger behind him. By definition, he doesn't know what's back there. It could be gases are being emitted. It could be a collapse that's going to happen. But he's got the light wherever he is. And down in front of him, there's, you know, hundreds of yards, maybe miles of coal mine. And there's untold danger and potential danger down there. But where he is, he has light. And that's what fear is like, right? We try to look past the light and say, whoa, what's out there, man? That's like, what's going to happen at the doctor next Thursday? Am I going to have cancer? I don't know. I'm not at the doctor next Thursday. When I get there, I'll have the light on my helmet and I'll know what to do. All the scary stuff is now illuminated and the action becomes obvious. It's been my experience for 27 years. So, you know, we're good. And we have people. I call June. I call friends of mine and just say, hey, you know, I'm a little wonky today. I need to tell you the truth about how small I got this morning and how much bigger I'd like to be by the afternoon, you know, and that's what I love about AA. It's like, you guys, you know, don't worry. I know that where I am, my headlight will be. And I know that I'm free because of this step and because of great sponsorship. And I ended a little early, but thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Matthew. Whew, that was absolutely incredible. Recovery is an invitation to grow. Oh my goodness. All right. We will end this with a ninth step prayer after a moment of silence. May we take that moment now. Higher power, I pray for the right attitude to make my amends. Being ever mindful not to harm others in the process. I ask for your guidance in making indirect amends. Most important, I will continue to make amends by staying abstinent, helping others, and growing in spiritual progress. Thank you.